Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Brandon Allgood, the Vice Chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Tina Seelig is the Executive Director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, the Entrepreneurship Center at Stanford University School of Engineering, dedicated to accelerating high technology entrepreneurship education and creating scholarly research on technology-based firms. In 2004, Stanford Technology Ventures Program was named NASDAQ Entrepreneurship Center of the Year. Dr. Seelig teaches courses on creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship in the Department of Management Science and Engineering and within the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford. Dr. Seelig was recently awarded the 2009 Gordon Prize from the National Academy of Engineering, recognizing her national leadership in engineering education. She has also received the 2008 National Olympus Innovation Award and the 2005 Stanford Tau Beta Pi Award for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching. Dr. Seelig earned her PhD at Stanford University Medical School in 1985, where she studied neuroscience. She's worked in management consulting for Booz Allen and Hamilton and is as a multimedia producer at Compaq Computer Corporation and was a founder of a multimedia company called Book Browser. She has also written 15 popular science books and educational games. We'd like to remind our listeners and audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club, and you are listening to What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, a course on making your place in the world with Dr. Seelig.
Hello, everyone. Was that a little loud? Okay, thank you so much. First of all, thanks to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me here today. This is an incredible honor and a treat, and I look forward to hearing your questions and having an engaging discussion with you over the next hour. So as mentioned, I teach high-tech entrepreneurship at Stanford as part of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. And essentially, our philosophy is that it's not good enough for scientists and engineers to get a purely technical education, that they really need to understand the business environment and the entrepreneurial world in which they're going to be working. Do you guys agree with this? Right. They need to understand, when they go into the business world, how to really make things happen. And so as part of this program, I also teach a course on creativity and innovation in organizations. And the entire philosophy of the course, or the overarching philosophy, is that all problems are opportunities. The bigger the problem, the bigger the opportunity. Okay? So you guys buy this? So this is something that I teach in my class, but you don't just have to listen to me, because this is something that venture capitalists and entrepreneurs all really embrace. They understand that the problems out there are really the places where you're really going to make a big difference. So I'm going to start off with a little video clip. I play this all the time. It's one of my favorites. It comes from our Entrepreneurship Corner website. And in fact, if there's one thing you take away from this talk, it's to go to this eCorner website. The URL is ecorner.stanford.edu, where we put together a huge collection of video clips and podcasts of entrepreneurial thought leaders. And this is a clip of Vinod Khosla. Now, for those who don't know, Vinod Khosla is one of the founders of Sun Microsystems. He also was a very, very successful venture capitalist and was at Kleiner Perkins and then started recently Khosla Ventures. So this is a 27-second long clip, and I play it for you now. I encourage you to play it every morning when you get up. Video is not working. There we go.
One thing I would say is find a big problem. To me, any big problem is a big opportunity. Because if you think about it, no problem, no solution, no company. Right? It's very simple. Every big problem is a big opportunity. If you don't have a big problem, you don't have a big opportunity. No. Nobody will pay you to solve a non-problem.
Okay, nobody's going to pay you to solve a non-problem. So the question I have for you is, how do you teach people to turn problems into opportunities? Okay, how would you do this in an educational environment? Is it like this? I mean, for the people who are listening, this is a picture in black and white of a bunch of people sitting in rows and columns. the chairs bolted to the floor, everyone facing the front of the room. They're probably taking a multiple choice test where there's one right answer. And I'm sure that if they talk to each other, they get in trouble, right? Is this how you teach creativity? Is this how you teach innovation? I don't think so. The way you do is like this. And this is a picture of somebody jumping off a cliff, you know, a bungee cord attached to their ankles. The point is, the way you teach innovation, the way you teach entrepreneurship, is by getting people out of their comfort zone. It's about giving people challenges where they don't know exactly what to do. And in fact, in my class, I never give the same assignment more than once. Because I, as the teacher, I don't even want to know what the outcome is. I want to give challenges where I'm as surprised as the students are by what they end up doing. And the idea is, you need to get students getting comfortable taking risks, doing things they haven't done before, and they need to feel it in their gut, you know, the way this guy feels jumping off of a cliff. Because learning to be entrepreneurial is about something that doesn't just happen in your head, it also happens in your gut. So I'm going to tell you a few stories of things that we do in our classes that hopefully will give you a sense of how we actually do this in a classroom setting. So let's flash back just a few years ago. And it was mentioned earlier that I teach in the design school at Stanford, which is pretty new. And the first year we were teaching, we had a course that was team taught. In fact, all courses are team taught, but this was an enormous team of people from all across the university teaching this class on design thinking. And I was asked to do 1 week focused on entrepreneurial thinking. How do you teach people to have an entrepreneurial mindset? And so I thought and thought, and I thought, what can I do? So I gave them a challenge. There were about 75 students in the room, and they were broken up into teams, and I gave every team an envelope. Now, how many of you have actually read my book? How many of you in the room? Okay. The folks who have read my book are not allowed to answer, because this is the story I tell in the first 5 pages of the book. Okay? So I'm giving you the intro that everyone else gets as well. I gave them an envelope, and it had seed funding in it. So for those who haven't read the book, how much do you think I gave them? $100. $100 going once, going twice. Anyone think another thing, number? A few dollars. A few dollars to $100. Anyone thinks I gave them more? $500. Well, I want to tell you, I went to the bank that morning, drew out the money myself, and I gave every team $5. And they knew that there was $5 in the envelope. They were told they had as much time over the course of the week as they wanted to brainstorm. But as soon as they opened up that envelope, they had 2 hours to make as much money as possible. So the question I ask you is, what would you do if you had $5 and 2 hours? What would you do? So for those who've read the first 5 pages, you can't answer. But I'm asking the other people in the room, what would you do if you had $5 and 2 hours and were challenged to make as much profit as you could? Any ideas? I hear the room mumbling. Well, let me tell you about some of the insights that happened. The teams that made the most money didn't use the $5. They had a huge aha moment when they realized that their skills and the opportunities around them were worth much, much more than $5. In fact, the $5 framed the problem way too tightly. Okay? So let me show you what some of the teams did. One of the teams, let me give you the rest of the assignment. This was started on Wednesday, and on Sunday they had to deliver one slide to me showing what they did. And on Monday in class, all the teams had 3 minutes to give a pitch on what they'd done. So that's the entire assignment. So one team went out, and they realized in the middle of campus, there are zillions of bicyclists. For anyone who's been at Stanford campus, it's almost a scary thing. You know, every day you don't hit a bicyclist with your car is a good day. And they realized that all of these bicycles need air in their tires. So they set up a stand in the middle of campus in front of Tresidder, and they put a sign up that said, "We will measure your bike tire pressure for free, but if you need air, pay us $1. Well, at first they thought they were taking advantage of their fellow classmates because there's a gas station right around the corner, and they could easily go around the corner to get the tires filled up, until they realized halfway through that people were incredibly appreciative. And so they changed their strategy halfway through. Instead of asking for $1, they asked for donations instead. They said, "It's free. You know what? We'll fill up your tires, but if you'd like to give us a donation, we would be delighted." And you know what happened? People gave them much more. And so this exercise shows something very, very important. They could have spent that entire 2 hours sitting in their room writing a business plan. And they would never have learned as much as getting out there and actually talking to their customers. They were able to experiment, to iterate, and to really figure out what worked. And this was a really interesting insight for them. Well, let me tell you what another team did. It was equally creative and very clever. They realized that on Saturday night in Palo Alto, there are really long lines at all the popular restaurants. And so they went out on Saturday night and they made reservations at all the most popular restaurants. And as their times came up, they sold the reservations. Pretty cool? They, too, ended up with some really interesting ahas. A, they realized that the women were much better at selling them. Somehow people trusted them more. And the guys were better at making the reservations. So the guys on the team ran around making the reservations, and the women sat there selling them. The other thing they realized is this worked best in the restaurants that have the buzzers, you know, that you get, that, you know, you can go around and go shopping. You don't have to wait there for an hour for your reservation, because it was something tangible that they could actually trade. This had an added benefit, right? If I then got your buzzer, you know, I could give it to you. I could say, here's a buzzer. It's going to go off in 5 seconds. You know, it's almost like a reverse hand grenade. You know, take this. It's going to go off. They then got the other one in return. And now they ended up having a reservation for a half hour later. They could sell later. So this was truly remarkable, and I was really surprised. You know, there were the teams that had lemonade stands and car washes, but they did not nearly as well as these teams who brought in several hundred dollars. But the team that really blew my socks off and everyone else's challenged all the assumptions. They looked at the resources they had, and they kept unframing and unframing and unframing the problem until they looked at the opportunities they had in a much grander scale than anyone else. They realized the most valuable thing they had was not the $5 and was not the 2 hours. They realized the most valuable thing they had was their 3-minute presentation time, which they sold to a company that wanted to recruit those students. And they sold that for $650. Pretty cool? So after the end of this exercise, I thought, you know, we are on to something here. This is pretty cool. But I did walk away with a little bit of a problem. I had a little bit of a challenge with this because I felt as though the messages that we were giving is that value is measured in terms of money. And clearly that's not the case in entrepreneurship. Value is measured in lots of different ways. So the next time I gave this exercise, instead of giving the students $5, this was the next quarter in my creativity class, I gave them a handful of paperclips. And I told them they had 10 paperclips and 4 hours to make as much money as they could. Or not as much money, to create as much value as they could, value measured in any way they wanted. And here's the deal. I was inspired by the guy, the one red paperclip guy, if you don't know, the guy who had one red paperclip and decided he wanted a house, and he spent the year, he set up a blog, and he traded the paperclip for a pen and the pen for a doorknob and the doorknob for this and that. And eventually he ended up at the end of the year with a house. Now, let's say it was in Saskatchewan, but it still was a house. And he started with a paperclip. So I thought I was being very generous giving them 10 paperclips. So what would you do? You guys now with know what you'd do with $5. What would you do with 10 paperclips? Any ideas? Well, let me show you what one of the teams did. And you tell me what you think. Okay, for those who are listening, they used the paperclip to break into a fraternity and steal $23,000 worth of private property. I need to say, by the end of them showing this, I was literally lying on the floor saying, I really used to like my job. I really was just in a panic until they said, just kidding. So what this team did is they took the paper clips and traded them for some poster board, and they made a sign that said, Stanford students for sale. Buy one, get two free. And they ended up going to the center of Stanford Shopping Center, and they went with this sign, and they figured, let's see what we can get. So first people started asking them if they could, you know, go and carry their bags or take out the recycling from their store, until the students realized, you know what, our skills are a little beyond this. And, you know, we're Stanford engineering students. So they started advertising that. And people started asking them to do more and more complicated things. And eventually a woman came up to them who was a business executive, and she said, you know what, you're in this creativity class. I've got quite a challenge at my company. I could really do with some great brainstorming. Could you come over to my offices and lead a brainstorming session? They said, no problem, we can do that. So they went over to her offices, they led a brainstorming session. It was incredibly successful. She got tons of ideas, and she paid them in 3 computer monitors that she didn't need. They were older monitors, but, you know, these students were delighted. So they came to class with 3 computer monitors, starting with some paper clips. And the other teams did equally well. They all defined value in really different ways, and this ended up being one of the most powerful exercises that we did the entire quarter. So then, a few weeks after we did this, I got a call from the Kauffman Foundation. So some of you might know the Kauffman Foundation. They're a very big foundation that's in Kansas City that focuses on entrepreneurship. And they said, we're going to be leading the first National Entrepreneurship Week in February. Would you like to be involved at Stanford? And I said, that would be terrific. So we put together a week full of activities. We had panels and workshops and lectures and all sorts of things for students to do and people from the community. But I kept thinking of that guy jumping off the cliff. And I thought, how can we have a week devoted to entrepreneurship if we don't get people's hands dirty and give them something to do? So I said, let's create a competition for this. And so we created the Innovation Tournament. And the first one we did was with Post-it notes. And I told the Kauffman Foundation we were going to do this. And they said, how terrific. Can we roll this out around the country? And I said, let's not stop there. Let's roll it out across the world, around the world. So with one email, I was able to reach my colleagues around the planet. They all got involved. They got their students involved. And this first innovation tournament engaged thousands of students around the world. And here's the deal. They were each given 1 pack of Post-it notes, 3x3 Post-its, 100 Post-its, and they had to create as much value as possible in 5 days. And all of their submissions had to be videos of 3 minutes or less. So what would you, let me just tell you why we picked Post-it notes. Lots of reasons. Post-it notes, first of all, they're, you know, symbolic of creativity, right? We use them for brainstorming all the time. They're also ubiquitous. Nobody can say that they can't find a Post-it note. And third, they're symbolic of turning problems into opportunities, because we all know the story about Post-it notes, which were a glue that didn't work that got turned into this, you know, incredibly successful product line. So what would you guys do if you had a pack of Post-it notes and had to create value in 5 days? Any ideas? Everyone's going to be shy today. Well, let me show you what one of the teams did, and you tell me what kind of value was created. What kind of value is created in that video? Conservation, saving energy, right? The students put Post-it notes all over the appliances in their dorm room, and they showed that fact that it said, it took us 23 hours to make this film. It takes only 1 second to unplug an appliance. This spring break, do your part, unplug it. This was posted on YouTube. It was watched by thousands of people. I know that for myself, when I went away on spring break that year, I unplugged all the appliances in my office. Pretty cool. A lot of value created in just a pack of Post-it notes. So this project gained momentum, and the next year, students were just waiting and waiting for what the next challenge would be. They'd been thinking all year about Post-it notes, and we filled Memorial Auditorium. There were 1,700 people there. John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, welcomed everyone to Entrepreneurship Week. I got up there to reveal what the next challenge was, and the air got sucked out of the room. Because the goal that time was to stretch their imagination. That year, the challenge was rubber bands, okay? And of course, everyone had been thinking of Post-it notes all year. Now they had to think about what would they do with rubber bands. So my question to you is, what would you do? You could use as many as you want, whatever color, what size, what shape. What would you do with rubber bands? No rubber band balls. Although some people did some interesting things with rubber band balls. One team created a public awareness campaign for breast cancer, and every donation that was made was another rubber band on the ball, and the ball just kept getting bigger and bigger. It was pretty impressive. Well, let me show you a video that was done by one of the teams, and you tell me what kind of value was created.
Tired of bikes gobbling up your laces? Troublesome doorways? Loose laces caught in vicious vacuums? Constantly fighting your garbage disposal for your shoes? Being hounded at school by shoe bandits?
You need shoe bands! With our revolutionary technology, you'll never worry about shoelaces getting untied again. Shoe bands will make you more stylish, lose 10 pounds instantly, and will save baby penguins from global warming. Everybody loves them!
50 years of R&D utilizing Six Sigma, lean production, and other buzzword processes went into the development of shoe bands. Procured from pencil erasers, our rubber is vulcanized twice to remove bad karma. Here's what our customers have to say.
As an athlete, I need my shoes to stay on. Velcro provides some security, but to really get the job done, I use my shoe bands.
Recently, one of our customers wrote in to tell us about an experience where her shoe bands saved her life.
Should have worn shoe bands.
Ever since I started using shoe bands, I jacked up my bench press by 50 pounds. Sometimes I even double band. Sometimes they double band you.
Hello, I'm the founder of Shoe Bands Incorporated. But not only am I the CEO, I'm also an avid and dedicated customer.
Through this exclusive TV offer, receive not two, but three packs of shoe bands for just five easy payments of $19.99. But wait, call in the next 60 seconds and we'll slash a payment and send you a llama. That's right, a llama. Order today.
Exclusive shipping and handling taxes may vary. Consult your physician before handling llama. And for more information, visit our website.
Okay, pretty cool. How do you like that public service campaign? You're going to buy these shoe bands. How many is that? In fact, we're going to sell shoe bands outside. But anyway, pretty cool. I'm very proud of these students. And you realize they did this, came up with the idea, implemented it, made a movie in 4 days. Pretty cool? So this was all wonderful, and I think you can see that this is a terrific way for students to learn how to turn problems into opportunities, how to leverage limited resources to create value, which is really, that's the hallmark of what it means to be entrepreneurial. But there are lots of other things that we teach, and there are a lot of other things that I talk about in my book. And one of them is about making your own luck. You know, when I grew up, my father, who happens to be in the audience here, always told me, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And that is wonderful. And I really was inspired by this and worked really, really hard. But I realized as I got older that there are lots and lots of other things that you can do to tempt luck your way. And the things that you do are things that people often don't teach you. And what they are is things about engaging in the world in incredibly meaningful way. So you can work hard and just sort of have your nose in a book all the time. But the way you can make yourself lucky is by talking to people, by looking at the world through a fresh set of lenses, and looking and finding the opportunities in your midst. So let me tell you a quick little story about this that might bring this to life. In fact, I actually could tell the story about how this book came alive, but I'm going to tell you a slightly different one. In fact, that story is in the appendix of the book, and it's all about the fact that I was talking to someone on an airplane and ended up turning that into a book contract a couple years later. But a few years ago, I was at a grocery store, and I was with my son, Josh, who was probably around 10 years old, and there was a man who came up to me and asked me how to make lemonade. And he had a can of lemonade, and he had an accent. He was certainly not from the area. So I explained to him how to mix the water with the lemonade concentrate and make lemonade. For most people, for most normal people, that would be the end of the conversation. They would say, thank you, and you're welcome, and it would be over. But I was very, very curious. So I ended up getting in line behind him at the checkout stand. No, I was not stalking this man. But I got in line, and I asked him, gee, where are you from? And he said, well, I'm from Santiago. I'm from Chile. And I said, oh, really? What are you doing here? You know, most people in our little local neighborhood store weren't from Chile. And he said, well, I'm going to be taking over my family's business in a couple years, and I'm in Silicon Valley for a while to learn about entrepreneurship and innovation. Bingo. I said, that's really interesting. I actually run this program at Stanford that focuses on entrepreneurship and innovation, and I'd be happy to help you out. So take my card. If I can be helpful in any way, let me know. So he sent me an email, and I was able to introduce him to a few people who could be helpful, and actually a friend of mine who was from Chile. And he ended up building quite a network, and I was helpful a little bit of a way. In fact, maybe about a year into it, he ended up bringing the president of Chile to Stanford with an entourage of about 250 people. And I still didn't quite know who this fellow was, but, you know, I just was being helpful and showed them around and introduced them to our program. A couple years later, I was going down to Chile. And I sent him an email, and I said, Eduardo, I'm going to be down in Santiago. Can I take you out for a cup of coffee? And he said, that would be terrific. So I, contacted him when I got down there. And he said, you know, unfortunately, I'm just so busy. I can't make it work. I can't get away. But do me a favor. Bring a few of your friends with you and meet at the lobby of this building in downtown. And I said, great. So I grabbed a few of my friends who were at the conference, and we went over there. We were met by one of his colleagues who took us to the roof of the building, where we were picked up by his family's helicopter, flown over the city, taken up to his family's ski resort, and then flown back down to the center of the city. And that's the point. Being entrepreneurial isn't just about turning problems into opportunities, you know, turning lemons into lemonade. It's about turning lemonade into helicopters. Kind of works, doesn't it? And that's the point, is that there are so many opportunities there. It's not just about looking at the problems you can solve, but taking the things around you and turning it into something much, much bigger. So there's another important lesson that I like to focus on, is the fact that you need to fail fast and frequently. You need to try lots of things and keep what works. And the fact is, if you put yourself out there, as I often do and a lot of entrepreneurs do, if you put yourself out there, you are going to have some failures. And failures are part of the process. In fact, it's pretty clear, and this is something you should really remember, the ratio between our successes and our failures are pretty constant. So if you want more successes, you're going to have to put up with more failures along the way. And in fact, I end up having my students embrace this concept by asking them to write failure resumes. That means resumes with their biggest screw-ups, personal, professional, and academic. And the idea is, it's okay to have a failure on that resume as long as you write down what you learned from it and try not to do it again. You might have to put a few lines, I did it again and again, and finally I learned. That happens to me all the time. But the fact is, it's something that you need to embrace. In fact, venture capitalists and entrepreneurs know this. If you look at the statistics and the success rate of venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, you would almost have to conclude that they invest in failures, because 80 to 90% of their investments don't work out. But it's because the ones that do work out that end up becoming big successes that make this work. So what I'm going to do is play you a video that came from the Innovation Tournament that captures the essence of turning failures into successes. And this is a team, well, you'll see, they ended up failing and turning into something pretty cool.
everybody has those days where one soft, sweet song's just enough to clear my head.
Thank you.
And we slide on over and accept fate. There's bound to be a powerful thing. And if it's just a joke, can we talk about it? It's getting so damn creepy just nursing this ghost of a chance. The fiction, the romance, and the technicolor dreams. Black and white. Strong. He thinks the living here is just plain. He's pushed down so hard you can hear him start to sink. And this one last round of petty conversation, you hold on, boy, cause you won't go down like this. You just roll over and lay down till it's more than you can take. It's getting so damn creepy, just nursing this ghost of a chance. The fiction, the romance, and the technicolor dream. Oh, black and white people.
Pretty cool. I mean, they failed, but instead of just throwing it away, they made a video that told the story about the failure and the fact that they realized that you need to celebrate that this is one of the stepping stones along the way. But here is the punchline. This team was a collection of biodesign fellows. These are postgraduates in medicine, in business, and in engineering. And they spend a year basically shadowing physicians, coming up with new inventions and ideas, and eventually putting together the plans for a new venture. This team that failed so miserably here went on to win the campus-wide business plan competition. 150 business plans, they came in first. They would never have come in first. They would never have had that success had they not known how to go through this iterative process of learning from failures along the way. Because I assure you that during that year-long process, there were many dead ends, there were many things that didn't work, and eventually they, though, stumbled upon something that really was a big success. And in fact, they've started a company and it's been incredibly successful. That, you know, they're going to get out the gate and have already raised money. So another point that I bring up, both with my students and in the book, is that you should not wait to be anointed. You know, people often are out there waiting for someone to give them a responsibility, waiting for someone to give them a job, waiting for someone to give them a promotion. But the fact is, in any organization, there are always white spaces. There are always opportunities. There are always places where you can make a difference. And it's up to you to find them. In fact, I had a revelation just the other day, is that when you get a job and they give you a business card, they give you a business card and they give you a key to the building. The business card you can throw away, but keep that key. Because that key lets you in to basically any door in the building. Any opportunity that is sitting there waiting. I have a little funny story to tell you about how I sort of figured this out. And I have my dad here in the audience, so he can tell you this is kind of true. In 1991, when I started my first company, I printed out business cards. And they said, Tina Seelig, President. And they showed them to my dad. Now, my dad was a really successful corporate executive who'd risen through the ranks from, you know, an engineer up to, you know, senior executive, you know, whatever, at a very large multinational company. And so he took a look at my business card and he said, what the heck? You just can't call yourself president? I mean, what chutzpah? And I realized at that point that entrepreneurs are those people who make their own business cards. They're the people who build the ladder below them instead of having someone put the ladder up in front of them. And it's that mindset that you need to have if you want to be successful, both in your own venture, but also within any organization, because you can be entrepreneurial anywhere you are. So I'm going to play you another video clip, And this is also came from the innovation tournament where the students had to create value with rubber bands. And this is one that captures the essence of the fact that there's a little tiny switch between doing nothing and doing something, and it ends up having very, very different consequences.
I worked out for the first time in weeks. I kissed my wife deeply with joy.
I finally took my chubby butt to the gym.
I carried a package for someone who was overburdened.
I said thank you more often.
I mustered up the courage to ask my crush out.
I spoke with my dear friend on the phone for an hour and a half. I am so glad to reconnect with her. True friends are treasures in life.
Let us tell you about how these work.
Okay.
These bands here, so we could try to rally everyone behind one cause, but we're not necessarily going to get people to agree with us.
The Do Band is based on two insights we had. One, you can't force someone to agree with your cause. Without buy-in, nothing real is going to happen. Two, everyone has their own cause, something they should do, they want to do, but they just never get to it. And this is what we're after. We want to get people over their block and get them to do it. Enter the Do Band.
The Do Band has a simple set of rules. One, put it on with a promise and don't take it off until you've fulfilled it. Two, record your success online. Share your story. Three, pass it on.
Every Do Band comes with a serial number. When you record your success, you can see what else your band has inspired. Each Do Band creates a chain of successes, and that's just one Do Band. With many Do Bands, it grows even quicker. And with the addition of the virtual Do Band, the numbers multiply astoundingly fast.
Do Bands. Blogspot.com.
What's happening with your Do Band?
Oh, I actually passed it off.
The Do Band creates value by appealing to our inner desires.
Done.
In just 36 hours, we created social value, health value, entertainment value, and political value, to name a few. We may not have collected $500, but Do Bands kicked off a new summer camp, initiated tons of phone calls to mothers, inspired compliments and apologies, healthy eating, and many other personal contributions to the greater good. These little things add up, and success is infectious. And one more thing. Actually, people did donate over $500 to the charities that they chose. And this is only the beginning. Imagine it.
Pretty cool. Yeah, in fact, it's interesting because I've told this story in different places, and there are now groups of students around the world who've started doing the same thing. They've gotten inspired by this idea. So even though they didn't get a Do Band, they've taken this whole idea, and the idea has been passed along in other places. So I want to go on to the next and final concept, which is never miss an opportunity to be fabulous. Now, I want to tell you where this came from. I mentioned I teach this course on creativity and innovation, and I never use slides in my class. I just never do, except for the first day. And the first day, I use some slides to tell the students what I expect from them and what I plan to deliver myself. And the very last bullet point on the very last slide says, never miss an opportunity to be fabulous. You know, in small font, it's not something that stands out, it doesn't have fireworks. And I basically say, listen, I promise to deliver the very, very, very best I can every single day. And I expect the same from you. I am happy to give everybody an A, but the bar is really high. And you know what happens? People just keep delivering more and more and more. And as the quarter goes on, the bar just keeps getting higher. I don't raise it, they raise it for themselves. Why is that? It's because people are waiting for this instruction. They are waiting for someone to say, there is no minimum you do to get an A. I mean, think about it. Most people in classrooms do that. Like, this is what you need to get an A. Well, can you imagine if everybody in the world did that? Well, I'm just going to do the minimum to get an A. Nothing amazing would ever happen. Amazing things happen when people take the top off, when they don't limit themselves, when they do things that stretch the boundaries of their abilities way beyond anything they could even imagine. So I love the fact that this concept is so sticky. People keep saying it again and again over the course of the quarter. It just keeps coming up again and again. I never say it again, but the students keep repeating it. In fact, the first year I did this, and in fact, this will date it by what ended up happening, I got to class a few minutes early, and one of my students was sitting outside, and she was listening to her iPod Nano, and the Nano had just come out, and I hadn't seen one. So I said, "Hey, Becky, can I take a look at that? I haven't seen the Nano before." And she said, "Great," and she handed it to me. And apparently, when you order one online, you can have it engraved with something on the back. You know, people put their email address or their phone number. And she turns it over to show me, and what is it engraved with? You guys know. Never miss an opportunity to be fabulous. That's what she wanted to look at every day. And I think that was just an incredible reminder that we need to tell this to ourselves, to our friends, to our colleagues. This should be our mantra. So I want to leave you with a final video. And this is a video that came from a movie that was made about the Innovation Tournament. Let me flash back to the story I told you about the Kauffman Foundation contacting me and saying, can we make this Innovation Tournament a national and then an international venture? They had a film crew, professional filmmakers, who were involved with capturing the week. And they didn't quite know what they were going to capture. So when they found out about the Innovation Tournament, they said, boy, that would be terrific to capture. So they called me and said, would you mind? And I said, I'd be delighted. So they put film crews around the world, in Japan, in Australia, in Ecuador, in India, in Thailand, in the United States, capturing what the students were doing with the Innovation Tournament the first year we did it with Post-it notes. So I'm going to leave you with a video, a short video that's the trailer for this movie. In fact, if you want to watch it, it's free. You can download it online. The website is imagineitproject.com. Just all one word, imagineitproject.com. You can go get this movie. So take a look at the trailer. I think you'll recognize some of our local heroes.
Imagine the future the way you'd like to see it.
If you can imagine it, then it can be.
Go to the problem and imagine a world where that problem has been removed, and then say, well, how many steps are there from this world to that world?
Imagining a new future, a new path, a new direction.
If you have the power to imagine it, you have the power to change the world.
Imagine a more perfect world than the one we live in. And then to actually engage in making that happen.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. I think about it every night and day. Spread my wings and fly away. I believe I can soar. See me running through that open door. I believe I can fly.
People think that pressure is that, but pressure in a very short period of time can be very stimulating.
It taps into the rawest level of their creativity.
It puts down the gauntlet of challenge and inspiration.
Sometimes silence can seem so loud. There are miracles in life by month.
You never have infinite resources, and you're given this constraint, and in this constraint, it's Post-it pads.
We define the value of our project as innovating outside of the box. And the box here is actually Post-it note.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky.
Entrepreneurship is an extreme sport. You gotta get out and do it.
This is an important way to progress in life.
It's an experiment in focus.
I bet you'll be blown away.
So I would argue that even though we have pushed these students off this perfectly good cliff, that through exercises like these and classes like the ones we teach at Stanford, that we're giving them a pretty good parachute and giving them the confidence, the creative confidence, to go out there and to challenge assumptions, to break the rules, to make their own luck, and to leverage limited resources to really make things happen. So I want to thank you very, very much, and I would be delighted to take any questions.
So please join me in thanking Dr. Tina Selig again. And so now begins our Now begins our question and answer period. I'm going to try and pass the mic around because for our listening audience. And so go ahead and raise your hands, and she'll call, and I'll try and run to you as quickly as possible.
Any questions? Here's a question over here in the front.
Oh.
How can non-students get involved in the Innovation Week?
Perfect. Good question. How do non-students get involved with innovation, the Entrepreneurship Week? First of all, Entrepreneurship Week is open to everyone at Stanford. Anyone can come. So it's in February. If you go to eweek.stanford.edu, you can get all the information. It's open to everybody. Also, we put the all of the content for our classes and our podcasts and our videos online. So even if you're not in the area, I really encourage you to go to our eCorner website, where all of this content is available to everyone for free. And in addition, the Innovation Tournament, you know, this next year it's going to be in November. And if you go to the eWeek site, you can sign up to get newsletters about what's going on. It's going to be really exciting. We are keep ramping it up in terms of the sort of organization and the infrastructure. And this year is going to be bigger and more exciting than before. And, in fact, it's open to anyone, you know, K through 12, adult, anyone is able to participate.
How did you come up with the title of the book, and did you think of the title after having kind of, you know, writing some part of it, or did it come
I'm before? I'm so delighted you asked that question. I didn't even plant that. How did I come up with the title? The story is the title came up before the book. About 4 years ago, when my son Josh turned 16, I panicked. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he is going off to college in 2 years. And fine, he's learned math and science and history and all of these academic topics. But I really felt that I hadn't done a very good job of teaching him all the things that I really wanted him to know about really making your place in the world. So what I did is I opened up a Word file on my computer, and I started making a list of all the things I wanted him to know when he went off to school. And it started out just as a list. And then what happened is I was asked to give a talk to the business leadership program at Stanford, and I thought, what am I going to talk to them about? And I decided to go and mine that list, and I created a talk called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, because they were about 20. And I ended up creating this talk, and I punctuated it with a lot of video clips of our entrepreneurial thought leaders. And what happened is it ended up being very well received, and I was asked to give that talk in a lot of different places. And on my way back from West Point, where I was giving it to 500 cadets, I said, you know what, maybe there's a book in here. And so I started putting together a book proposal, and you'll have to read the appendix of the book to find out what happened. It's kind of a circuitous path, but it ended up turning into a book. And the cool thing is it came out the week my son turned 20. So it came out the week he turned 20. So, thank you.
Okay, so we've got $5, we've got rubber bands, we've got sticky pads. It seems like it really doesn't matter what it is that you're given to create out of, right? So is it kind of, in a meta sense, right, is it kind of a way of just saying, do what you can with whatever is available and think outside of categories? And to that extent, it's like it seems like it's a pattern thing. Like, are people just locked in patterns
exactly.
of how to do things culturally?
Exactly. People limit themselves. There's a wonderful exercise that I borrowed from someone else, I don't remember who, that I do in my class. I have the students come up with problems they have. Whatever problem, it could be, you know, in their personal life, their professional life, academic life, and they have to sort of spin around in their apartment and pick an object randomly. And they have to figure out how that object, that random object, is going to help them solve their problem. And you know what? It always works. They always can figure out. I mean, let me give you an example. There was a woman who was in an apartment, and she was moving the next week. And she had some furniture that was way too big to fit in her little car. And she said, how am I going to move this? If I don't get this furniture moved by the end of this weekend, I'm in big trouble. I'm just going to have to leave it here. So she spun around her apartment, and she ended up landing on a case of wine that was left over from a party she had given. She said, okay, how is this case of wine going to help me move this furniture? And she said, aha. She went on eBay and said, I will trade someone a case of wine for a ride across the Bay Bridge with my bureau. And within 2 hours, it was moved. Pretty cool? Do we have any other questions? Yeah.
I appreciate all your positive attitude, and I am the wife, the proud wife of Flasher the Clown of San Francisco, who has been kicked out of many parades because of his act, having a dog in his pouch, which was meant to have a kangaroo, a joey in a pouch, and people misconstrued it as having a dog in the pants. So we've taken a negative, which is simply your attitude, which I love it, and because of the negativity that has been this drummed up with all kinds of scum of the mind of the earth, of turning this into a terrible event, which I thought was a cute little thing with a clown with a joey in his pouch, has turned into a positive. Because of this, nationally, he's become the most famous clown in the whole United States.
Well, I guess they say there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Yes, so you can take negative publicity and turn it into a positive, and I like that attitude.
Great, thank you.
You learn and grow from your negativity.
With the advent of our current environment, how do you prepare students for the next stage in this particular environment, which sees a lot of risk dynamics that have not been seen in years and years? These entrepreneurs that walk into your class and, quite frankly, trade dynamics that don't have the same impact as if they work outside the classroom. And how do you integrate that?
Okay, really good question. Interestingly enough, in this environment, the number of students who are choosing to start companies has skyrocketed. And I can give you the data to back that up. Because what they've done is they've looked at now the risk profile of taking a traditional job and starting their own company, and they've realized they've almost equalized. And so many students are saying, you know what, now's the time for me to do it. So we had many, many more business plans in this year's business plan competition. And here's what happens. The goal of our classes is not to generate more entrepreneurs, more founders. Because if you think about it, I mean, if you look at a company like Google, are the founders, are Larry and Sergey the only entrepreneurs? I certainly hope not. You know, it's the reason that they love to hire our students is because they're very entrepreneurial and they want entrepreneurs throughout their organization. So we certainly don't measure our success by the number of companies that get started. And one of the things that's really important for us to do is to teach students what's involved with starting a new company so they can make the decision whether they have the risk profile for it before they go out and do it. And many of them say at the end, boy, you know what, I don't have the risk profile. You know what, I love to be in this environment. Maybe I'll become a lawyer and deal with intellectual property. Or maybe I want to be on the marketing team. Or maybe I want to be, whatever, something else. They decide where they fit based on their risk profile, where they fit in the ecosystem.
Hey, Tina, you're extraordinary. Unlike the rest of us, to what extent did you actually know this stuff when you were 20, and to what extent did that actually lead to your success?
You know what? I did not. I mean, you can ask my parents. I was this really nervous little kid who, like, looked under my bed and had to keep lights on and was afraid of the world, really and truly. And over time, I just got more and more comfortable. I am pretty outgoing. As if you didn't know already, I'm pretty outgoing. So I put myself out there, and I found that most of the time, good things happen when you put yourself out there. And that's what I just kept reinforcing, trying lots of things, keep what works. I mean, think about this. I started out as a neuroscientist. I actually thought I was going to go to medical school. And I started out as a neuroscientist and ended up now teaching innovation and entrepreneurship to engineers. I mean, that path was very circuitous, and I made lots of right angles. Let me tell you one quick little story to demonstrate that. And you'll get a sense. I graduated with my PhD in 1985, and It was a really bad job market. I mean, it was equivalent to, you know, they keep saying it hasn't been so bad since 1985. Well, that's when I graduated. It was really, really, really hard to get a job. And I could not get a job. I looked and looked and looked. I was out of work for 6 months and eventually got an introduction to the head of, well, what ended up happening is I didn't want to stay in the lab. I wanted to go and work in industry. I wanted to work in the new, booming, brand new biotech industry. But I didn't want to be in the lab. I wanted to be on the business and strategy side. But why would they possibly hire me? I had zero experience. So what ended up happening is I got the introduction to the head of Booz Allen in San Francisco. And I walked in. My goal was to impress them enough so that they could maybe introduce me to some of their clients who were in life sciences. That was the goal. It was part of my networking. But I walked in, and the guy said, why would someone with a PhD in neuroscience be a good management consultant? Now, I could have told him the truth, which was I really hadn't even considered that. It hadn't occurred to me that that would be a good fit. But I didn't. I thought quickly, and I said, well, gee, doing brain research and doing management consulting is exactly the same skill set. And he said, tell me more. And I said, well, yes. And, well, listen, you laugh, but listen, you got to figure out what the burning questions are. You need to figure out where you're going to collect your data. You need to collect all your data. You need to analyze it. You need to present it in some compelling way. You need to, you know, come up with some presentation to your client. And then you need to figure out what the next set of burning questions are. Well, he introduced me to a few more people that afternoon, and I walked out with a job offer. So I have done that many, many times, made very radical turns in my career, and have found that nothing I have ever done has been wasted, and everything I have done has built my base of knowledge and has given me a confidence that I could almost go into almost any environment and figure out something that I could do to make a contribution.
All right, great. Join me again in thanking Dr. Tina Seelig.
Great. For anybody, for anybody who's interested, there are a few books outside, and I would be delighted to sign them for anyone who's interested.
All right, and thank you to our audience and our listening audience. This has been a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 106th year of Enlightenment discussion. Thank you. Adjourned.